From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Democrats lay out $2.2 trillion in tax increases as part of their budget reconciliation bill. Plus, where will the Senate parliamentarian draw the line? Welcome, Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, WSJ columnist Bill McGurn and editorial writer Kate Batchelder Odell. Wednesday, today, September 15th, was the informal deadline that Democrats had set for finishing committee work on their budget reconciliation proposal. So we're getting more details about it all the time. But one of the biggest news drops was the tax plan, which would reportedly raise $2.2 trillion over a decade and be the largest tax increase as a share of gross domestic product, as a share of the economy, since 1968. And Bill, I guess the first question is this a real proposal that's going to get through? And do Democrats expect it's going to be politically popular?
I don't know if they expect it's going to be politically popular. I wouldn't want to be a Democrat in that position in a swing state for an issue, because it's an extraordinary bill, the tax implications for this, and it goes far beyond what's necessary. And I think Mrs. Pelosi is really making them walk the political plank on this. And I can't imagine why they're doing this. And it has a potential for blowing up spectacularly in their faces. And I think it may even blow up more if it's passed.
Just to dig into some of the details, one of the things that you'll be hearing is the rate on the top marginal rate on the income tax, which is currently at 37%, and this proposal would raise it to 39.6%. But Kate, I think that's a little deceptive, because the Democratic plan also involves lowering the thresholds at which that rate would apply.
Right, Kyle. So under current law, these rates kick in at about 520 for an individual and 628 for a married couple. And it looks like what Biden wants to go to is $400,000 for individuals and $450,000 for married couples. So that is consistent. You know, he's been using this $400,000 a year line as his political marker. But the thing here to really note is that the brackets creep down much further onto people who earn less money than they do under current law. One particular thing to note here is that there's only a $50,000 difference between individuals and married couples, meaning it is a really high penalty on second earners. Kyle, that can be particularly true if some of these higher earners are, getting to the top of their career, and if they don't have children under 18 in the house, they won't qualify for the large new child tax credits. So these could be some pretty ferocious tax hikes, especially when you add in everything else. I mean, there's a new 3 percentage point surcharge on money over $5 million. You've got the Obamacare investment surcharge. These effective rates, marginal rates, start to get quite high.
Just to underline that point about the individual rate versus the married rate, I mean, this is what policy folks call a marriage penalty. And essentially, it's two individuals don't hit that highest tax bracket under this plan until they each get over $400,000 of earnings, so $800,000 total. But then they marry, and if they file jointly, this tax plan says that first rate hits at $450,000, which is obviously a lot lower of a figure. And Bill, I mean, it just strikes me as another one of these unintended consequences that our policymakers, when they're drawing up numbers and carve-outs and complicating the tax code even further, find it hard to envision how they will affect the real world.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's one of the characteristic shortcomings of a lot of Democratic tax policy. It just assumes there are no unintended consequences, and this is a particularly perverse one. And I think, frankly, the whole bill is fraught with these kind of things. We're not going to, I mean, to flip Nancy Pelosi on what she said about Obamacare, we're not going to know how awful this is until we pass it. And I think it's going to have a lot of debilitating effects on people's earnings and so forth. And I think it will prove very unpopular. They're playing the populist card that who cares what happens to rich people. You know, they're hoping that most people say, you know, anyone making over $400,000, they're so rich, I don't care what happens to them. But as you were kind of suggesting, it has a lot of implications for people lower down the line in income with these very perverse incentives.
Kate, you brought up the top marginal rates when they stack, and that's part of what makes these incentives so hard to foresee. Is in the U.S., we have these multiple layers of taxation. So you start with that top federal rate of 39.6 that's being proposed. There's also proposed a 3% surtax on people earning more than $5 million a year. There's this 3.8% net investment income tax. And then there are state and local tax rates. In New York, the combined state and New York City rate, top rate is 14.8%. In California, the state rate, top state rate is 13.3%. And it's hard to believe, but when you start adding all that stuff up, what you get to is some rates on the next dollar of income that people would earn that are close to 60% on the dollar, which I can't imagine would have anything but really bad incentives for people.
Sure, Kyle. And maybe I'd take a little issue with the point about unintended consequences, because it's intentional in at least one sense. And it's intentional to do this to the brackets, because to get the kind of money you need to pay for these large new entitlements that Democrats want to start, and we can hopefully talk more about those later, to get the money that you need, you have to move further down the income scale. There's this pretense that you can raise all of this money by just raising taxes on people that everybody that agrees are, you know, extremely wealthy. But this move down from $620,000 to $450,000, this will continue. These high rates will continue to reach further down the brackets, because that is what is required to finance the Democratic proposals. So that, I think, is underappreciated when we talk about, they just hit wealthy people. But yes, to your point, states also tack on their own additional surcharges and taxes. And I was reading that I think the top combined capital gains tax rate could average 37% under this plan. So we are talking about much larger tax increases than are being advertised. I think the Democrats are trying to make their proposals look not radical, but when you add in all of these this and that's, it really does get quite startling.
And you can have a similar conversation about stacked rates and incentives on the corporate side. Currently, the top corporate tax rate is 21%. This Democratic plan would raise it to 26.5%. But then again, there are state and local rates, and the Journal's editorial on this tax plan says that if you add them all together, the combined average company rate on company income would be 31%. And that does not look all that favorable if you go looking around the world. I mean, check out the Tax Foundation document, corporate tax rates around the world, 2020. This is what we consider bedside reading at the Journal, some of us do. And it says the lowest rate, or Europe has the lowest regional average rate at 19.99%. Or if you weight the calculation by GDP, it's 24.61%. But still, Bill, I mean, the whole point of this lowering the rate in the 2017 tax return, the tax reform, was to make the U.S. more competitive, to quit all these inversions of companies moving overseas. And this would take a big step in the opposite direction again.
Yeah, that was a big thing, right? Remember all the inversions? They were going to low tax places like Ireland because they had a competitive environment. What's extraordinary about this, what you lay out, it doesn't seem that this question is asked. I mean, it's one of the reasons they want a global minimum tax on everything, because then they don't have to worry about competing so much. But people with a lot of money and companies with money to invest, they're looking around at the environment and they're making a decision, you know, where they get the best return. And these decisions seem to be based without any consideration of American competitiveness on these issues. And I think, you know, if this goes through, we're going to see a lot more about the inversions or people closing down, because we've made the U.S. a much more hostile environment for investment.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of the Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Bill brought up a moment ago Biden's pledge not to raise taxes on anybody making under $400,000 a year. And the slipperiness of that, it seems to me always, Kate, is first of all, corporate taxes, all the economists say, fall on workers. They don't fall entirely on the owners of the corporations or shareholders. Although sometimes, you know, regular people in their 401ks are also shareholders, I should add. But also there are things in here like increased taxes on tobacco, nicotine products to the tune of about $96 billion. And so how does Biden navigate this, Kate, this pledge that he wasn't going to raise taxes on anybody making under $400,000 a year with all these incidental things that are getting thrown into this reconciliation bill?
Right, Kyle. So they are basically stuck looking through the couch for coins to pay for their priorities. And this tobacco tax is one of them because they can say on paper that it will raise $100 billion, though I think in reality it will be much less as cigarette smoking continues to decline, which is a great piece of news. But one thing I did want to point out that is really particularly crazy about this regressive tobacco tax is that it puts a $2.25 per pod tax on vapor products and about a $2 tax on a pack of cigarettes. So there's been a lively debate about how much safer non-combustible vapor products are than cigarettes, but everybody agrees it's significantly safer. So there is dysfunctional excise tax that taxes the safer products at higher rates in this current draft. So that's a bad for harm reduction in addition to being, like we're discussing here, just an extremely regressive, falling predominantly on the poor.
So on the question of the politics of this, I mean, one thing that's odd is that Democrats are in some sense negotiating with each other on the size of this bill. And Joe Manchin is still insisting, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, is still insisting that he's not going to vote for more than $1.5 trillion of spending. And Bill, it seems to me that the Democrats in the House are sort of calling his bluff on that, because he says he won't spend more than $1.5 trillion, and yet they are preparing a tax plan that's going to raise $2.2 trillion.
Yes, he's laid down a clear marker. He wrote a piece for our pages about this. I don't think there's any way to wiggle out of that. The Democrats are betting that he will wiggle out. He'll feel enough pressure. The other problem is, so you have the Joe Manchins who would, and they're probably a bunch of silent Joe Manchins who don't want to vote for this big thing because it will put them crosswise with the public next year in the elections in the House. But they can't say anything. On the other side, there are the progressives. And the danger of the progressives is that they've proved in the past they're all too willing to sacrifice a concrete victory for some purist, kind of proposal. Remember AOC killing Amazon siting in her district and so forth. So they're willing to do it. And a lot of them say if they don't get the whole cabana, they're going to vote it down. And again, Mrs. Pelosi has only a few votes to spare. And in the Senate, there's a problem. What if Bernie goes the other way from Joe Manchin? So I think they're in a tough place. And I think they're hoping at the end that they'll just be able to move Mr. Manchin along. You know, it's my fear that what if they agree on $1.8 billion? Will he then say that's a compromise? That's kind of my worry at the time. I think the whole bill is bad. I think the irony is that Joe Manchin is actually if they listen to him, saving the Democratic Party from what I think will be a terrible legacy. But none of them seem to realize that they all seem to regard him as the enemy.
So we've talked about the tax piece a bit, but we could do a 10-hour podcast on everything that is going into these reconciliation bills and through these congressional committees right now. Kate, are there other pieces of this that jump out at you as particularly important that listeners should pay attention to?
Yes, Kyle, I would love to do a 10-hour podcast, but I think our listeners have a lot going on. but I am watching very closely the healthcare and entitlement pieces of this. The healthcare sections are more significant than the Affordable Care Act, and they're only a third of the bill, and include a new dental and vision and hearing benefit in Medicare for which is already on the road to insolvency. We're going to make new, larger Obamacare subsidies permanent. That's one thing I'd really, really be interested to dwell on here is that so these Obamacare subsidies that were made temporary in the emergency package, they'll be permanent now. They basically allow some upper income families to get healthcare subsidies. You also, and this is a theme in the bill because it also includes a paid family leave entitlement that it works on a sliding scale in that if you earn $100,000 and you need to take 12 weeks of paid family leave, you can get kind of almost half of your wages replaced by the federal government, even if you're married to someone who earns six figures or have other options. Ditto for the provisions about childcare, which are really large grants to center-based childcare. Those also are, I think the draft is trying to calculate those based on how expensive childcare is your area versus how much people make. The bottom line for listeners here is that they should look closely here at the how significant some of these entitlements are for upper middle income people who we would not consider in need of the social safety net. So I think when Americans hear these proposals, they think, I'm a generous person who wants the government to help people in need. That's why I think these proposals merit such a close look, because we are talking about expanding the entitlement state pretty radically to give checks to people who do not necessarily need them.
Another thing to keep an eye on as this bill gets drawn up is the Senate's parliamentarian. Since this is a budget reconciliation bill that can pass with only 50 votes in the Senate, essentially bypassing the filibuster, there are certain rules that surround the bill, and provisions that go into it are supposed to have some budgetary effect. This is a budget reconciliation process. And yet there are at least a few that are going to get challenged, Bill, it looks like to me. I mean, one of them is immigration reform. There are provisions that would essentially give green cards, permanent residency to millions of people. There are some provisions that change labor law and put up some civil fines on employers that get dinged with unfair labor practices. And Bill, I mean, what's your sense of how much the old school, the Byrd rule, as it's called, these budget reconciliation restrictions are going to be applied to this bill?
Yeah, well, first we have to go back to why is there a Byrd rule? And the reason is that reconciliation is a shortcut. It's kind of a gimmick. I'm not in favor of bills going through by reconciliation. It's kind of a gimmick. And they realize that because of this gimmick, shortchanging the normal protections that are built into the process, that they had to have some limits, or you can do anything, because you can, you can make anything a budgetary item. So, the biggest limit is that it has to have an effect on the budget, which seems clear cut. But I'd say two things about it. One is the ordinary American citizen can understand that an immigration bill should not be something that's under the budget, under the reconciliation process. There are a lot of things even that we might agree with as policy, but they should not be done in reconciliation. They should be done through the normal progress of Congress. And on the other hand, we also know that anyone can take any provision and make a budgetary argument for it, as ridiculous and extenuated as it is. And that's what we're going to find out, if the parliamentarian is going to stick to it, whether the Byrd rule really means what it says, or, you know, when times get tough and the pressure really starts to increase, whether Congress, and in this case, particularly the parliamentarian, is going to stand by principle.
And some of these calls, it looks like to me, to my eyes, are not all that difficult. I mean, obviously, if you give green cards to millions of people, that's going to have some effect on the federal budget. But it's hard for me to make the case, or hard for anyone, I think, to make the case that that is a budgetary item. I mean, the point of the policy is so far removed from outlays and revenues. I mean, it reminds me of the instance in February when Bernie Sanders wanted to use a budget reconciliation bill to put a $15 minimum wage mandate nationwide. And a similar sort of thing. I mean, obviously, that would have some effect on the federal budget. But clearly, the point is not to increase revenues or outlays. On the other hand, some of these look like maybe they're more difficult calls. One of the things in these Democratic proposals is a clean energy program, and energy providers that increase their clean energy by a certain percentage will get some payments, and energy providers that don't will have to make payments. I don't know if those are penalties or taxes or fines, however it's going to be couched. But that, Kate, to me is maybe a harder call.
Yes, Kyle, certainly. I mean, note the just ridiculousness that we are organizing this entire bill on what will survive the parliamentarian instead of what the policy is, right? So we have gotten stuck into this reconciliation process. And so some clearly, like we've been discussing, they are trying to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And some things will probably survive that otherwise wouldn't have if they had been considered independently. But I think one of the real results here is that when bills go through bird baths, as they're called, when they take out all the extraneous provisions, you can end up with a really worse product because of the things that you have to do in budget reconciliation. And so what listeners should expect here is, you know, they're going to jam through whatever they can jam through, but so many of these new entitlements and programs are going to be decided in the administrative state by regulators who will write the details in. And that is really just not how Congress is supposed to work. But that is where we're at when you use this process.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my last thought here is just that the more open-ended reconciliation becomes, I mean, it's going to be used by both parties. If the parliamentarian here allows Democrats to rewrite provisions of labor law, you know, whether employers can permanently replace workers for going on strike is something that's in here. That would be banned. I mean, to me, that's not a budgetary provision. And if that's that sort of stuff it can just now sail through reconciliation, then Bill, it seems to me that the next time Republicans are in control of Congress, they're going to do the reverse.
Well, that's the, you know, that's the argument for a lot of things like stacking the Supreme Court or the filibuster. You know, you can rue the day. It looks very good when you have the opposition and you feel you can roll over them with the change. But you have to look forward to the day down the road when the power situation might be reversed. And I hope they do look forward to that. I fear the temptation is so great right now. And I think that they also recognize that the party needs a big victory right now after the debacle in Afghanistan. So what I'm afraid is that they're going to push this through by hook or crook. And it's just so dubious. And I think it will also, in addition to all the things Kate laid out and so forth, I just believe it's going to have a really negative effect on the economy. I don't think it's a gift to Joe Biden to pass this thing, because I think it's done without any sense of the consequences that they're going to have. And I just seems to me that most of them are determined to put it through, including the leadership.
But I guess the argument I'm trying to make, Kate, is that the more the reconciliation process comes to look like regular legislating, I mean, it becomes a way to kill the filibuster without actually killing the filibuster. And Joe Manchin has stood up and said he is in favor of keeping the filibuster. He's drawn a line there. Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona has done the same. But if they're willing to circumvent the filibuster, then what difference does that make, I guess?
Right, Kelly, we will be stress testing the reconciliation process in this, and we've seen some of that as well as Democrats, you know, ask for rulings on can we do this as many times as we want versus once a year, right? So, and that would definitely be, you know, a way for them to end the filibuster without having to take the political accountability of doing it. So I do think that is one thing to watch in this process of how much stress can reconciliation take. I agree that the filibuster seems like it survives for now, but the question is what will happen after during this process and afterward.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Bill. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.